41-year-old Leah Rollins was working the morning shift at a local gas station. Just the day before, she'd been promoted to manager, and she was excited to take the next step. But just hours into her shift, she would come face to face with a brutal killer. Around 10:30 a.m. on the morning of March 10th, 1997, Leah was shot three times after being robbed. The killer, moments earlier, had stared directly into the surveillance camera before having Leah lie down, where he subsequently executed her. Investigators had a lot of evidence, fingerprints and surveillance footage which clearly depict the killer, though the license plate of his car was illegible. While investigators have argued that the crime was most likely random, committed by someone passing through, some members of Leah's family believe it could have been a killer for hire, paid for by Leah's own ex-husband. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 135, The Murder of Leah Rollins. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the horrifying murder of Leah Rollins. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. The show is also available on MeWe and Minds. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon available at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions directly through the website or email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. As a final note, I just wanted to let you know I'll be taking next week, November 3rd, off. However, I will be releasing a short update episode in place of the regular full-length episode. I'll return to normal episode schedules on November 10th. Leah Rollins was starting a new life and putting it together piece by piece. But before she could see her dreams come to fruition, she was cut down in a moment of grisly violence and madness. This is episode 135, The Murder of Leah Rollins. Monday, March 10th, 1997 was a chilly morning in Kozid, Nebraska. Wedged between Gothenburg in the west and Lexington in the east, the small town of less than 4,000 residents is seated just north of I-80. Few cars pull off the busy interstate to stop in Kozid, though when they do, it's often to fill up at one of the nearby gas stations, maybe head inside, grab a snack for the road. However, that busy corridor does open up the small town to visitors who may have never known it was there. And while many of those visitors enjoy the quiet, relaxed atmosphere, others come looking to transform that solace into horror. Unfortunately for Leah Rollins, she would have a fateful encounter with just such a nightmare. It was a good morning for the 41-year-old divorced mother of two. Just the previous day, Leah had been promoted to manager, and Monday morning would be her first shift operating under her new title. According to friends and co-workers, Leah was a very polite, kind and caring woman who was well-suited to her job, socializing with many of the customers who would enter the small convenience store attached to the gas station. Just after 10 a.m. that morning, while Leah was assisting another customer, a red Pontiac Grand Am pulled in, stopping to fill up. The driver pumped nearly $20 worth of gas into his tank before striding into the store. As Leah was finishing up with her other customer, the man lurked in the back of the store. Moments later, gunshots would ring out, and Leah Rollins would be left lying on the floor behind the counter while her killer vanished into the early afternoon. Leah Rollins was born on Sunday, September 25, 1955, in Exeter, Pennsylvania, to parents Roy and Mary. Leah was born into a large family, being one of eight children, with her having four sisters and three brothers. According to the Lincoln Star Journal, while Leah had been born in Pennsylvania, she would spend much of her life in Arkansas. Leah was a bright, warm, and loving child who got along well with her siblings and, after overcoming a bit of childhood shyness, became a very outgoing and fun-loving woman. Leah's brother Roy described his sister to ABC News, saying, quote, She was my sister, a good-hearted person. She was generous. She got along with people, had an outgoing personality. End quote. A coworker described Leah as the type of person that you want to work with. Understanding, patient, and never too serious to share a laugh. There isn't a great deal of information available about Leah's life. Frankly, there isn't a great deal of information available about her murder either. But we do know Leah would go on to marry a man named Barry Rocap Sr. Rocap, alongside Leah, owned and operated a restaurant in St. Thomas, often referred to as the gateway to the Virgin Islands. Together, they would have two sons, Brannon and Brian. While her children were the brightest lights in her life, the marriage itself was plagued with issues which Leah would later recount, including both physical and verbal abuse. In desperation to escape from the situation and create distance between her and her future ex-husband, Leah hatched a plan. While the exact details have never been fully revealed, Leah managed to leave St. Thomas with her two sons and a considerable sum of money that she felt was her share from owning and operating the restaurant with her soon-to-be ex. Frightened and having to start her life over again, Leah would spend time with family trying to put the pieces back together. Not wanting her sons to have any doubts about why they had fled, Leah would write a 16-page letter in which she documented much of the abuse she had suffered at the hands of their father. Leah went into great detail about how fearful she was of her ex and explained that she had done what she thought was right at the time to save herself from a dangerous and terrifying situation. This letter, later delivered to police in the aftermath of her murder, was written approximately a year before her death. In or around mid-1996, Leah began a new relationship with a man named Bob Haar and embarked on a new journey which would lead her away from her family and into the small town of Kozid, where she moved closer to be with Haar, who worked as a part-time dispatcher for the Kozid Police Department. According to friends, Leah was extremely taken with Bob, and the relationship offered her all of the things she had previously been missing: a warm, compassionate, and caring partner to build a secure, safe future with. Sadly, the move to Kozid meant being away from her sons, who were staying back in Arkansas. When asked about Leah, co-worker Twyla Lee explained, quote, "She was a good person, happy, and friendly. I don't know how anybody could hurt her," end quote. Lee went on to explain that she and Leah got along well and that she often teased the 41-year-old about her accent and, of course, the starry-eyed look she'd get whenever Bob's name came up. Reportedly, in addition to her happy relationship with Bob, Leah also found herself falling in love with Kozid, the small town presenting the option of a new and bright beginning. Sadly, all of Leah's dreams would be destroyed in an act of mindless violence which, to this day, haunts her family, friends, and that quiet town. In two previous cases, those of Deborah Poe, who was abducted from an Orlando convenience store during her graveyard shift, and Kelly Berg Dove, taken from a Harrisonburg, Virginia gas station during her overnight shift, we've explored the dangers of working alone during late-night shifts at gas station convenience stores. However, in Leah Rollins' case, this brazen crime would be committed in broad daylight. While in the aforementioned cases, investigators had a severe lack of evidence to work with and timelines established only by eyewitnesses, the Amoco station in Kozid had several surveillance cameras which were able to help investigators construct a minute-by-minute account of exactly what happened. According to the tapes, a 1993 red Pontiac Grand Am bearing a rear license plate believed to be from California pulled into the station at approximately 10:23 a.m. The driver, a Caucasian male, exited the vehicle and approached the pumps, beginning to fill his tank. It was noted that the man was not wearing shoes and had his sweatpants folded over and pulled up so that they stopped just below his knees, which was considered odd attire since the temperature at that time was in the low 50s. Inside the store at that time, Leah was working with a female customer and her child. The unknown driver finished his work at the pump, ringing up $17.20 worth of gas. The man then walked towards the store, entering quietly as Leah finished with her customers. While Leah worked the register, the man proceeded to the back of the store And it's been theorized by investigators that he was killing time, waiting for Leah to be alone. At this point in the surveillance tape, the unknown man seems to taunt the cameras as he pulls open a cooler door, lifts a bottle of soda from the shelves, unscrews the cap, and begins drinking. A few moments into his drink, the man lifted his chin, looking directly into the camera before continuing to chug down more of the soda. Around this same time, Leah was finishing up her transaction and the customer and her child walked out, getting into their vehicle and driving off. According to the timestamp on the tape, the unknown man approached the counter at 10:32 a.m., placing his soda down as though he was going to pay for it. There's no sound on the tapes, but the actions of both Leah and the man seem to indicate that he was directing her to open the cash register and empty it. Leah can be seen popping the drawer open and removing the cash before handing it over the counter. At this point, it appears that the man directed Leah to lie face down on the floor behind the counter. She complied, and at no point in the tapes did she give any resistance to the robber. If robbery was the sole motive, the transaction was complete, and the man was free to make his getaway. But for unknown reasons, he made a much more violent and lethal choice. After a few seconds paused, standing there, looking around for a moment, at 10:33 a.m., the man reached into his front right pocket and produced what was later determined to be a 9mm semi-automatic pistol. Leaning forward against the counter, the man arched his back, bending his front half over the counter, pointing the gun down towards Leah, who was lying face down and had no idea what was about to happen. In total, the man fired 3 shots. The first 2 struck Leah in her left arm, but the 3rd shot ended her life, entering the left side of her head. Less than a minute later, the man grabbed a pack of cigarettes and a lighter, in addition to the soda he was drinking and the cash handed to him by Leah, later determined to have been $150. At 10:34 a.m., the killer turned and exited the store, returning to his red Pontiac Grand Am, now with a full tank of gas. He stepped into the car, started the engine, and drove out of the parking lot. While the cameras captured his vehicle, the footage was later analyzed, and it was far too grainy for investigators to make out the exact license plate number. Years later, the COZID police would send that videotape out to NASA, hoping their advanced systems would be able to enhance and correct the footage, but it was unsuccessful. Investigators have never been able to determine the number, though if they could, they might be able to track down this killer. Police would be notified of the terrible crime when a customer later entered the convenience store but couldn't find anyone working there. As the customer approached the counter, they made the grisly discovery and dialed 911. Investigators arrived on the scene and immediately began to search for evidence. In addition to the surveillance footage, which gave them a very clear view of the killer, especially during the point where he looked directly into the camera, multiple fingerprints were recovered. Reportedly, between dusting the gas pumps and the counter, police were able to pick up nearly a full set of prints, but at the time, they weren't able to get any matches in the system, which would suggest that whoever the killer was, he had not previously had his prints entered into any law enforcement systems. Investigators canvassed the area, setting up a roadblock to question passersby, though it didn't appear that anyone had seen or heard anything, nor had anyone witnessed the red Grand Am in the area before or after the crime. Considering the proximity of I-80, less than half a mile to the south, it was theorized that the killer had likely gotten on the interstate, though police had no way of determining which direction he may have gone, east or west. With such limited information, police quickly sent out that information about the vehicle and the driver to local and state police, hoping that someone might see the Grand Am. Surveillance footage showed the customer who had been in the store prior to the killer entering, and police managed to identify and track her down. While the witness did recall seeing the man, she wasn't able to provide much information beyond a basic description, which matched that which police had seen on the tapes. The suspect was described as being a white male in his early 20s, standing 6 feet 3 inches tall and weighing approximately 225 pounds. On the surveillance tape, the man was seen wearing sweatpants, which the legs were pulled up to just below his knees, no shoes, no socks, a black leather bomber style jacket over a black or dark gray hoodie. Leah's murder shocked the town of Kozid. Residents who were known to keep their doors unlocked at night suddenly became much more security conscious, believing that if this could happen in their little town, then it could certainly happen again. While locals were dealing with the terror, it was left to Leah's family to deal with the tragedy. Her two sons were devastated by her loss. Their mother had been taken from them for seemingly no good reason. This was an aspect of the case that investigators found themselves stuck on as well. Leah had complied with the robber. She hadn't done anything to try and resist, and yet, when she was at her most vulnerable, he opened fire, taking her life. At the time, there were a lot of different considerations. Was this the result of the killer wanting to buy himself more time to escape, knowing Leah would have called the police when he left, or was murder always the target, with robbery only being secondary? While investigators had fingerprints, an eyewitness, surveillance footage, and the make and model of the car, the case began growing cold quickly. It appeared obvious that, whoever the assailant had been, he likely didn't live in the area and may have simply been passing through. In hopes of getting additional assistance and drumming up new leads, the police turned to what was a rather new avenue to disseminate facts and information on the case. In 1997, that new avenue was the internet. Kozid Police Chief Alan Baldwin spoke to the Beatrice Daily Sun, explaining, quote, "It's just our vehicle to pump up some information out to other places in the United States. We're hoping that someone is going to get on the internet and say, 'I know who this is,'" end quote. Still photos from the surveillance footage were posted online, in addition to a description of the killer and the crime itself. In addition to the case information, it was announced that a $12,000 reward was available for any information which could lead to the identification and arrest of the killer. $2,000 had been put up by a local citizen of Kozid, while Amoco Petroleum Products put up an additional $10,000. At the same time, investigators told the Fremont Tribune that they were considering bringing in a hypnotist to speak with potential witnesses, to aid them perhaps in recalling memories of the incident which they may not have consciously picked up on. A week after Leah's murder, Kozid police set up roadblocks and began questioning drivers again. Sergeant Greg Tetley explained to the Tribune that it was their belief that people follow routines, and it was possible that someone who drove by the gas station the Monday morning Leah was killed may drive by again, and perhaps they had seen or heard something but hadn't heard about the investigation or didn't realize what they had seen was important. It was also stated that investigators had multiple leads they were following up on, though they didn't expand on what those leads were nor how the investigation was progressing. Unfortunately, whatever leads had been developed and tips called in, they apparently weren't getting investigators any closer to solving the bizarre and disturbing crime. In June of that year, 3 months after Leah was killed, it was announced that America's Most Wanted would run a segment on the case and show the surveillance footage. Within days of its airing, police received more than 30 tips and potential leads. While these leads were tracked down, there were no results. The case, which had been going cold since nearly the first day, began to grow colder. In hopes of developing new leads, the Kozid Police Department enlisted the assistance of both the Nebraska State Patrol and the FBI. A representative of the FBI told the Lincoln Star Journal that they were looking at several different suspects, though they had not yet developed enough evidence to charge anyone in particular. With the goal of spreading news about the case further, hundreds of flyers bearing an enhanced image of the suspect were circulated around Kozid, as well as gas stations and truck stops all along Interstate 80. At this point, it was announced that the reward for information had been increased to $22,000. Unfortunately, progress on the case seemed to come to a grinding halt around this same time. There wouldn't be another update until 2003, some 6 years after Leah was gunned down. In February of 2003, investigators announced that they had received an anonymous tip. The tipster saw a rerun of Leah's America Most Wanted episode, and it jogged a memory he had of a bizarre conversation which had taken place 5 years earlier, 1 year after Leah had been killed, according to the Lincoln Star Journal. The tipster claimed that a friend of his, at the time, living in Omaha, had told him that he had shot and killed a convenience store clerk in 1997. According to this tip, the killer was living in North Omaha around the time of the murder, and while investigators were given a first name, they didn't share it publicly as the tipster apparently could not be completely certain that it was the man's real name. 5 years had passed, and he couldn't really recall accurately. Either way, this ignited a fire under the Douglas County Sheriff's Office, who began focusing part of their investigation in the North Omaha area. Despite their attempts to track down this lead, investigators were never able to locate the man the tipster had described, and they remain uncertain if it was a case of mistaken identity or if the tipster himself had simply made the story up. As quickly as the case had begun to heat up, it once again went cold. In 2015, a new series of articles were written about Leah's murder. 18 years had passed, and it seemed police were no closer to discovering the identity of her killer. While police had come to the conclusion that the murder had likely been random, Leah's brother, Roy, had a very different opinion. Not only did he not consider the murder of his sister random, he believed he knew who was responsible for it. Roy explained that he believed Leah had been the victim of a hired hit, paid for by none other than her ex-husband, Barry Rokap Sr. When speaking with ABC News, Roy stated, quote, "I think he was behind it because of the kind of person he is, a very dishonest person. The guy who killed my sister comes into that gas station with clam diggers on. That's when your pants are rolled up to your knees, and that's not what people in the bayous or the southern hemisphere do. So this guy is in Nebraska, which is not warm. Comes in with his pants rolled up, which tells me that he was from St. Thomas, the Virgin Islands, and I think my brother-in-law paid him to come up and shoot my sister." End quote. Sergeant Tim Kostronik of the Dawson County Sheriff's Office didn't outright deny that possibility, telling ABC, quote, "Knowing her past and digging deeper into her past and what she did, I could see how he could be so frustrated if she took money from him and left him the way that she did. He didn't have somebody come up here and have her executed." End quote. Leah's ex-husband passed away earlier that year in 2015, taking whatever secrets he may have held to the grave. While for many, this is considered a good potential theory, there's never been enough evidence or information gathered to make a solid link between Rokap and Leah's killer. Whoever the man was, he seems to have disappeared into the same emptiness from which he emerged. His fingerprints have never gotten a hit in the past 23 years, which leads investigators to believe that either he managed to never get arrested, or perhaps he died not long after Leah's murder. Today, the murder of Leah Rowlands remains open and has grown, sadly, very cold. Justice has remained elusive for her family, and for 23 years now, her children have had to grow up, never knowing the truth of who killed their mother or why he chose to do so. A $5,000 reward remains in place for any information leading to Leah's killer. Despite the passage of time and the absence of any major developments, Sergeant Kostronik is still determined that the case will eventually be solved, explaining to ABC News, quote, "We are never going to give up on Leah, and so it's our duty and obligation to make sure we follow up on every potential lead. I would hope that he is somewhere close, because I hope to live to see the day to look him in the eye and tell him he's caught, along with others, several law enforcement officers that have had the opportunity to work this case." I'm constantly looking for the best clean nutrition to help me stay healthy, active, and feeling my best, but that can be so much harder than it sounds, especially when you're lactose intolerant and very sensitive like I am. Well, I'm so happy I found Orgain. It's an absolute game changer. The Orgain Sport Protein Powder is a unique blend of organic ingredients that help build strength and optimize both performance and recovery. I mix it into a smoothie or shake for a quick on-the-go drink. On those lazy mornings when I need that extra spark to start my workout or want to stay sharp throughout the day, I reach for the Sports Energy Powder. It's packed with electrolytes and adaptogens for optimal performance, no matter what I'm doing. We all know how you recover is just as important to how you work out. Orgain has a special sport recovery powder that maximizes restoration. It replenishes tired muscles with a unique blend of plant-based organic ingredients, including adaptogenic mushrooms to help reduce inflammation. And I'm not the only Orgain sport powder believer. Pro golfer and U.S. champ Bryson DeChambeau loves Orgain too. Sitting around the house for the past few months, it's been difficult to keep eating healthy and stay motivated to work out. But Orgain is so quick, easy, and effective, I can in good conscience not do it. Plus, it tastes really good. Thanks to Orgain, I finally found the best clean products to help keep me healthy and support my performance. And right now, you can save 20% off your first order. Plus, when you subscribe, you can save even more. Go to tryorgain.com/trace. That's tryorgain.com/trace for 20% off your first order plus extra savings when you subscribe. tryorgain.com/trace. Nowadays, there are a lot of different entertainment options available, but you could be missing out on some of the most compelling international shows out there. With Acorn TV, you can break out of the domestic bubble and experience some of the amazing shows the world has to offer. Acorn TV is a commercial-free streaming service that's rooted in British television. It's home to sophisticated and artful storytelling with top-rated mysteries, addicting dramas, heartfelt comedies, and so much more. I love how I can just install it on my streaming device and watch it from the comfort of my own home or take it with me on my phone. Lately, I've been getting really into My Life is Murder, an Australian detective drama starring Lucy Lawless as former detective Alexa Crow. Even after retiring, she can't keep herself away from solving crimes, and each episode is exciting and approaches crime drama from a new angle. I'm also super documentary obsessed and recently been fascinated by The Detectives, a series following a special unit of the Manchester Police. Clearly, I can't get enough true crime. I always find something new to watch on Acorn TV because it's loaded with thousands of hours of binge-worthy content. You can stream on all your favorite devices for just $5.99 a month. Escape to Britain and beyond without leaving your seat. Try Acorn TV for free for 30 days by going to acorn.tv and using my promo code TRACE. That's acorn.tv. Code TRACE to get your first 30 days for free. Acorn TV. It's a story we've heard before. A lone individual working in a gas station convenience store becomes the target of an unknown assailant. In the previous cases we've addressed, the attacks happened in the late night hours, between 2 and 3 a.m. when no one was around. If you've ever worked an overnight job, one where you're alone and exposed to the public, there's a sense of fear that can come with it. You never know who's going to come walking in that door in the middle of the night and what intentions they might have. Somehow, when the sun is up, it feels safer. It feels more secure. But Leah's case is a prime example of how some killers will strike no matter what the circumstances. It's a horrible story. A woman raises her children, escapes an abusive marriage, starts a new life, and before she even has a chance to really get the ball rolling, she's struck down in a moment of brutal and senseless violence. One of the factors of this case, which has baffled investigators and Leah's family for more than 20 years, is why the robber killed her. She didn't try to fight back. She didn't appear to do anything to draw his anger. She calmly acquiesced to his orders, laid down behind the counter as he directed her. There was no need to kill her unless he just wanted to. There have been a couple of different theories about this. Some people believe Leah could have known her killer and would have been able to identify him. Others have suggested that maybe the killer believed that if he left Leah alive, she'd call the police and he'd get caught. Still, others have argued that the murder may have been the motive all along, and the robbery was done not only to confuse the case, but to grab some quick cash because why not? The truth is, until he's found, we'll never know for sure. Another detail which makes this case stick out so much different in comparison to the cases of Deborah Poe and Kelly Berg Dove is that a large amount of evidence was acquired. Multiple fingerprints, surveillance footage which was captured, and has very detailed images of the assailant, a description of the vehicle, the type of gun used. In a lot of these cases, the victim vanishes and little is left behind, but here we have so much, which may only add to the frustration that it's yet to be solved and the killer yet to be identified. Strangely, despite this large amount of evidence, the coverage of this case is extremely limited. Newspaper articles revolve around the week surrounding the murder, then grow more sparse until years pass with no updates, no articles, nothing. Maybe that's due in part to the lack of development, but maybe if this case was more widely known, some answers could be found. While the tips called in following the airing on America's Most Wanted never panned out, most investigators believe that there's someone out there who knows the person that committed this terrible crime, robbed Leah of her life, and robbed her children of their mother. Looking at stills from the surveillance footage, the man's recognizable. These aren't exceedingly blurry images, and if you knew the man, I think you'd be able to pick him out. While the description of the car is known, down to the color, make, and model, the license plate was illegible, and despite multiple attempts to clean and enhance the photo, police have never managed to be able to do so. Focusing in on the man, to describe his outfit and behavior as bizarre is an understatement. Firstly, we have to address the fact that the guy wasn't wearing shoes or socks. Now, sure, some people drive without their shoes on, but I don't think it's really common to not only pump gas but walk into a convenience store barefoot. Most stores have rules about this kind of situation, and oftentimes businesses will not allow people to enter without shoes. Some people have speculated that the man may have been on drugs, maybe suffering from a mental illness, or simply didn't care. Others have gone far enough to consider the possibility that entering without shoes may have been done in an attempt to force a confrontation, for Leah to tell him he couldn't come in, to give him an excuse to attack. Police felt that when the killer looked into the camera, what he was actually doing was somewhat of a dare, like he was communicating directly with the police, who he knew would later look at this tape, as if to say that he was going to do what he wanted to and they couldn't stop him. That's certainly a possibility, though others have argued that maybe the man looked up, saw the camera, and once he realized he'd been caught on tape, he figured it didn't matter anymore, so why bother trying to hide his identity? It's certainly one of the creepier aspects of the case because at that point, Leah was still alive. Was he looking into that camera while he was considering what he was going to do, or did he walk in knowing all along that he was going to kill whatever person he found inside? Either way, it left investigators with a haunting image. What I find most bizarre about the case is the way in which the murder was committed. The killer didn't pull his gun out when he was ordering Leah to empty the register. He didn't brandish it. He didn't point it at her. While we have no idea what was said, it seems apparent that he explained to Leah that he was robbing her. He may have told her that he had a gun, but it's almost as if he didn't have the courage to point the gun at her while she was looking at him. We know that when the killer entered the store, he waited for the previous customer and her child to leave. Why he did this has been heavily debated, with some believing the killer simply didn't want to have to kill three people to cover his trail, while others think maybe he didn't want to kill a child. Frankly, trying to psychoanalyze such a bizarre pattern of behavior is nearly impossible without further information. After the robbery was complete, the killer made Leah lie down behind the counter, face down. In the few moments that pass between her lying down and the shots being fired, there appears to be almost a moment of consideration. Is he thinking about whether or not to kill her? Is he glancing around to make sure no one else is going to hear the shots? Again, we don't know, but after this short consideration, the killer pulls a 9mm from his front pocket, leans halfway over the counter, and fires three shots. Two strike Leah in the arm, but one hits her in the head, killing her. I've never understood this. Why ever lie down behind the counter when you could have shot her while she was standing? Why not walk around behind the counter and shoot her from a more direct angle rather than awkwardly leaning across the counter? I admit, not much about this case makes sense, but there's something so strange about the way the killer acted. I don't think anyone who has ever looked into this case has ever truly understood what was happening in those final moments. I also think the items taken are a little weird. We know Leah handed over $150 cash from the register, Not exactly a large score, but sadly we've seen people killed for less. He takes the soda with him, the one he'd been drinking while he was looking into the camera. He also takes a pack of cigarettes and a lighter. Now, I'm a smoker, and I find it really difficult to believe that in this moment, you'd only grab a single pack of cigarettes. Why not grab a handful or a carton? It's another strange detail about an already bizarre case for which there are no logical answers that seem to fit. For 23 years now, these questions have remained, and we don't appear to be any closer to answering them today than we were back then. So, maybe we're never going to fully understand what was going on, why things were handled the way they were, why the killer chose to murder Leah rather than just walking out. He didn't seem like he was in much of a rush, and it's 10:30 in the morning. Anyone could have pulled into a spot and came walking in during the robbery. In a lot of cases, robbers will grab the cash and just run out. Here, he waits. He takes his time, he pauses, and then he shoots. From everything I've seen and read, it doesn't seem like he rushed out of the store either. He didn't speed out of the parking lot. For someone whose behaviors were so strange, he seemed fairly calm and casual about it, which may be part of why investigators have theorized that this wasn't his first murder, and there's a chance it wasn't his last. In terms of the crime itself, there are predominantly three theories which have been suggested. Some believe that the killer knew Leah and may have specifically targeted her. Others believe that the crime was completely random and possibly committed only because the killer was driving along I-80 and needed to stop somewhere for gas. Finally, Leah's brother has argued that this was a hitman-for-hire situation, one arranged by Leah's ex-husband as retribution for the way she had left him and the money she had taken. So, let's start at the top and work our way down. Is it possible that the killer knew and specifically targeted Leah? There doesn't seem to be a lot to suggest that there was any personal connection between Leah and her killer. While there's no audio on the surveillance footage, there doesn't seem to be any recognition on Leah's part. There was simply him dictating orders and Leah complying. Beyond that, Leah had lived in Kozid for a little over a year when she was killed. The town had a small population, but no one recognized the killer. If there was any kind of personal connection, it would have had to have been established somewhere outside of that town. And that's certainly possible. There just doesn't seem to be any evidence to make the connection. Now, there is the possibility that this could have been someone who knew Leah, but she simply didn't know him. Maybe a customer who had been to the convenience store before, or who had seen her somewhere in the past and decided to stalk her. That's not something that can be ruled out, but again, we don't have any information which would make this seem more likely. Frankly, the man entered the store and killed time waiting for Leah to finish with the other customer. If Leah had known him, you'd imagine there would have been some kind of exchange either as he walked in or as he walked up to the counter, a wave, something. Judging from the way the man behaves, there's certainly a feeling of randomness to the crime. And that leads us into the second theory. If there's ever been a case which feels random, it's this one. There's a couple of different angles to the random theory. Considering the proximity of I-80, it's not entirely possible to rule out that this could have been so random that it revolved completely around convenience, for lack of a better term. The killer's driving along I-80, notices that he needs gas, pulls off at the next exit, and finds himself in Kozid. It's difficult to accept that things can be so random, but this could easily be the case. The guy decides he's not going to pay for his gas, and while he's there, he might as well rob the place. Now, if you're planning to rob a business, that's one thing. But if you're planning to kill the person you find in there, that's a different story. The killer had gotten what he wanted. Leah went along with his demands. Her murder was completely unnecessary, which leads many to believe she was killed for no reason other than that the killer wanted to. Some have suggested that the killer may have struck because he didn't want to leave any witnesses, but does a guy who leaves fingerprints everywhere while staring into a surveillance camera sound like the type of person who's very concerned about being described by a witness? It just doesn't make any sense. The only logic I could put there is that maybe the killer believed Leah would call the police and he wouldn't have enough time to get away. That's a possibility that can't be dismissed out of hand. There's been a lot of debate about the killer's potential mental state. Some think perhaps he was on something and getting cash to be able to resupply, Others think there could have been more of a level of mental illness involved. Still, others suggest that he could have been a transient, someone just traveling through with no real home or destination. All of those are possible, though when it comes to the idea of the killer being a transient, it's somewhat difficult to accept. He was driving a nice car that was only a few years old. While he wasn't wearing shoes, he did have a hoodie and a leather bomber-style jacket. I think a lot of people get caught up on the fact that the guy was barefoot, and I understand that, but I don't personally think that means there's a link between that and him being a transient. It seems almost like the guy was trying to stand out. The way he dressed, the way he looked into the camera, the lack of gloves, the casual way he left afterward. It almost feels like this guy either wanted to be caught, didn't care if he was caught, or somehow knew he wouldn't be caught. He must have known his fingerprints weren't in the system, so he didn't have to worry about that. There's a part of me that wonders if this guy knew his life was going to be over soon, maybe due to his own hand, or he simply didn't care what happened to him and therefore anyone else. The fact of the matter is, when you look at this case, the one thing which has helped conceal his identity more than anything else is the fact that his license plate was illegible. If that camera would have been a little more clear, they'd have had somewhere to begin looking. It's not like he went out of his way to hide the plate. It was just a matter of pure luck on his part and misfortune for the investigators. But what if it wasn't random? What if it wasn't someone who knew Leah, but instead someone who had been directly sent to kill her at the behest of her ex-husband, as Leah's brother has suggested? We don't know a lot of details about exactly what happened between Leah and her ex-husband, but what we do know paints a dark portrait of a difficult and abusive marriage from which she felt it necessary to flee. We know that when Leah did leave, she took her two boys with her and an undisclosed sum of money. Judging from the fact that Leah was working as a manager at a gas station convenience store, I'm not under the impression that she took a large sum of money that would have afforded her the ability to live a much easier, comfortable life. If nothing else, it likely just made escaping easier. There's been a lot of cases where someone has hired a hitman to kill a significant other or a former spouse. That's not something that's completely out of the realm of possibility. In that business, you tend to get what you pay for. And for the most part, someone who's going to get the job done efficiently isn't going to be cheap. So it becomes a matter of how much a person is willing to spend to commit a horrible crime. The problem with this theory, though, is that if this guy was a hired gun, he was not in the slightest concerned about anyone recognizing him. Most of the time, a hitman, or at least a hitman who operates on a professional level, is going to take steps to protect their identity, to leave behind as little evidence as possible. This guy doesn't. He seems to go out of his way to leave evidence behind. If a hitman wanted to kill Leah, there were plenty of opportunities. On her way to work, on her way home, when she was home by herself, when she was out shopping. Why walk into a local gas station on a Monday morning when you know it's going to be busy and commit this crime seemingly without regard for being caught? It just doesn't make any sense to me. Now, that doesn't mean this couldn't have happened, and it doesn't mean this couldn't have been an arranged hit, but if it was, this guy didn't seem generally concerned about anything. But again, maybe you get what you pay for. The main issue I have with this theory revolves around the idea that the guy came from St. Thomas, where Leah and her ex had a restaurant. That seems to be based entirely on the killer's manner of dress. I admit, the way he dressed was weird, but I don't think the absence of shoes along with his pants pulled up to his knees suggested he was from the Virgin Islands. You would think, if anything, he would be more cold being in Nebraska rather than hot. I imagine it would be a lot more difficult to hire a hitman, have him travel to the States, commit the murder, and then flee back to the Virgin Islands. It seems more likely you'd just hire someone who was already here, but sure, maybe he wanted to be extra careful, maybe he had connections and wanted to go with someone he knew. However, if that was the case, the guy he selected doesn't seem to have had it together at all. Can I say this is impossible? No, but when you put all the theories side by side, this doesn't feel like the most likely scenario. Unfortunately, with Leah's ex-husband deceased, there may be no way to ever know for certain, short of finding the killer himself. 23 years ago, 41-year-old Leah Rollins was struck down by a cold-blooded killer while working in the small town of Cozad, Nebraska. She left behind two children who still don't know why their mother was taken from them. For Leah's family, it's been a nightmare which has never ended. And while the occasional calls from the FBI do come through asking follow-up questions, hoping for updates, there has been basically no major movement on Leah's case since that cold March morning in 1997. Unfortunately, without new information, a tip, or an outright confession, the murder of Leah Rowlands will remain open, unsolved, and very cold. What do you do to keep your mind sharp? For me, I enjoy the excitement and challenge of trivia, and if you're like me, then you need to play Trivia Star. It's the best way to test yourself. Trivia Star is a free mobile quiz game that's entertaining and challenging. You can choose categories like music, sports, movies, TV, animals, or celebrities. There are over 60 categories to choose from, so there's always more trivia to explore. If you choose the correct answer from multiple choices and beat the clock, you move on to the next level. The questions get harder over time, but if you get stuck, don't worry. You can use coins and gems to get hints and beat the level. And Trivia Star has 2,000 five-star reviews in the Apple Store. Join them today and see if you're smart enough to win. Right now, Trivia Star is offering you 2,500 coins and 500 gems when you download and play. Just go to the Apple or Google Store and search for Trivia Star. Again, search Trivia Star and enjoy 2,500 coins and 500 gems. Download Trivia Star for free today. If you're looking for more information about the murder of Leah Rowlands, there are not a lot of sources out there. A few old newspaper articles, a couple of recent articles, but most of them contain the same information, and there's not a lot of expansion into the major depth of the details of this case. If you have any information about the murder of Leah Rowlands, please contact the Cozad Police Department at 308-784-2366. You can also contact the Nebraska State Patrol at 308-535-8047 or the Dawson County Sheriff's Office at 308-324-3011. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or comment in the Facebook group. I think it's important to note that October is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. The United States Department of Justice estimates that 1.3 million women and 835,000 men are victims of domestic violence each year. Every 9 seconds, a woman in the United States is beaten or assaulted by a current or ex-significant other. 1 in 4 men are victims of some form of violence by an intimate partner. If you or someone you love has been the victim of domestic violence, you are not alone and there is support available. You can use the Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 1-800-799-7233. Or you can visit thehotline.org to talk online. All assistance is free and completely confidential with 24/7 support and resources. If you simply wish to help, you can also make a donation at thehotline.org. It's time that everyone stands up against domestic violence. Did you know that CrimeCon is coming to the United Kingdom and will be in London on June 12th and 13th, 2021? And I'll be there representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. I'm really looking forward to being a part of this amazing event. And if you're considering going, you can use the promo code TRACE21 for 10% off your ticket. That's TRACE21 for 10% off. Visit crimecon.co.uk for more information. I'd like to take a moment now to thank our amazing Patreon producers: Alicia Lorraine, Astrid Maria Nyer, Aurora K, Brittany Bivens, Brian Kemmerling, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Dearthy, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Guillerme Pinto, Jennifer Winkler, Joni Berkowitz, Kate Much, Michael Draves, Nick Mohar Schurz, Pamela Coburn, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Mascarotolo, Travis Skepko, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Tom Archer, Tracy Woods, and Zari. You're all amazing and your contributions are greatly appreciated, as are all patrons. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or visit trace-evidence.com for further information. I want to thank you all for taking the time to listen, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.